Welcome to Class Matters, an educational program examining the role played by social classes and the class divide in the U.S. and around the world. I'm Rich Whitney.
I'm Paula.
We discuss matters of class because class matters. And here on Class Matters, we've often been very critical of Congress as being basically under the control of the military-industrial complex, the CIA, and the rest of the deep state, big pharma, big finance, and the other big players in the U.S. ruling class. Capitalist class money funds most of the activities and campaigns of the two corporatized political parties and their candidates, and that is why we are actually living under a plutocracy, rule of the wealthy, even though our government maintains the formal machinery of democracy and the illusion of democracy. You can cast a vote, but in most instances, you only get to choose between getting screwed by the ruling class's Democratic Party operatives or getting screwed by the ruling class's Republican Party operatives, and maybe the vote will be accurately counted, or maybe it won't, depending on who is doing the collecting and tabulating of the ballots. But there are exceptions to the rule. Sometimes people with real principles, who at least try to act in the interests of the working class on some issues some of the time, or even most of the time, do manage to get elected. One of those exceptions is Senator Rand Paul from our neighboring state of Kentucky. Like his father, former congressman and two-time presidential candidate Ron Paul, Senator Paul has, at least in our experience, been a stand-up guy in opposing the war machine and various acts of war, challenging the federal government's corruption of science and public health, opposing the misbegotten and oppressive policies imposed on us during the COVID debacle, and opposing the attacks on free speech and other core civil liberties that have been imposed by the newly created censorship industrial complex that we've spoken about on this program. Senator Paul was recently interviewed by constitutional lawyer turned independent journalist Glenn Greenwald on his program System Update, which you can find and watch for free at rumble.com. As Glenn stated in his introduction, he spoke to Senator Paul about the ongoing wars in Ukraine, Gaza, and the Middle East, the likelihood of further interference by the U.S. security state, and our domestic politics as we head toward the 2024 election, the growing censorship regime of online political speech, and why neocons and their various cousins are so eager to drive the U.S. to start a war with Iran. At a time when Congress is debating war policy and struggling more than they have in years to find a way to deliver billions more to keep various wars funded, and at a time when opponents of Biden's war policy in Ukraine have been utterly vindicated, Senator Paul is the ideal person to discuss the unfolding events in Washington. So with that, we thought it would be informative and interesting to share with you a large segment of Greenwald's interview with Senator Paul. Without further ado, let's take a listen.
Senator Paul, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Glenn.
Absolutely. So let's start in the Middle East, since there are a lot of wars and conflicts going on, even by U.S. standards. We are financing Israel's war in Gaza. We are involved in bombing Yemen without congressional approval. We're bombing multiple targets in Syria and Iraq that we say are affiliated with Iran. If you look at polling data, pretty much for the last decade, Americans overwhelmingly want to be done with Middle East wars. Candidates who run for president always claim that that's their goal too, and yet we seem to always find ourselves not in fewer and fewer wars in the Middle East, but more and more wars in the Middle East. Why is that?
You know, even when there's a success like in ISIS and destroying ISIS, and we were a big part of that, we never come home. And so recently when people said, well, what should we do? They've attacked, you know, 100 different places where we have troops in the Middle East. And my response is, why do we need 100 different places in the Middle East? But I think they ask the wrong question. They keep asking, what are we going to do to retaliate? As if the retaliation ends it. It actually often begins a cycle of retaliation and then retaliation. But the question we really have to ask, and this question I ask repeatedly, what good is 50 men and women in, you know, in a barracks in some remote part of Syria? I think we're in 10 different places in Syria, but not more than 100 or 200 people in each place. And I keep asking the question, who goes to war with 200 people? They're ineffectual. They're not militarily strategic to do anything, but they end up being a target. I mean, Iran can't attack us over here. Iran's proxies can't attack us over here. They can attack us when we're in close proximity to them. And so it's of no value. I think no military strategic value to be in all these small little locations all over the Middle East. But in the end, it ends up being sort of a tripwire to draw us into more and more conflict. And you ask, why are we still there? Why does it never end? I think because it's set up as a schoolyard debate where if you shrink away from it, you're thought to be cowardly or you're thought to not be strong enough in pro-America if you're willing to remove troops. And you saw what happened. Trump tried to take 200 troops out of Syria, and the machinery, the military industrial complex machinery, went crazy on him to remove 200 troops. And in the end, he backed away. And I said at the time, 200 troops is of no value in the middle of Syria other than being a target.
So this is something that obviously doesn't really break down along party lines. You have a Democratic president, a Republican president, members of both parties in the Senate with whom you serve in the House seem to support these policies. And what I want to get a sense of, there's obviously always been an idea that the U.S. has to be in the Middle East because of access to oil, but these countries have made clear they're very willing to sell oil to the United States without us having to have military bases there. Is the reason that we continue to deploy all these bases and put our troops in harm's way, is that because of an ideological belief in Washington that that's really something the United States should be doing? Is there a profit motive that is driving this? What is the reason that Washington continues to do this for decade after decade?
You know, I think the economic argument was stronger at one point in time. Oh, we have to protect Saudi oil because we depend on Saudi oil. None of that's really true anymore, and I don't think those arguments hold water as much. But the argument, I think, is still the simplistic argument that we must make America, we must make the world like America, and we have the might to do it. If we don't do it, China will do it, or the Soviet Union will do it. And these arguments date back even into the Cold War. So the strongest proponents of intervention overseas are people like Mitch McConnell and people like Chuck Schumer, who are older products of the Cold War and still thinking as if the Cold War still exists. But, you know, the argument's not a new argument. I can remember maybe 20, 30 years ago reading a book by Jonathan Quitney, who wrote a book, Endless Enemies. And it's just about all the people we supported. During the Cold War, we would support you just because you were anti-Soviet. So if you're anti-Soviet, but you were a dictator that killed your own people and didn't have elections, oh, well, no big deal as long as you're pro-America and anti-Soviet. That sort of argument is somewhat gone. But it's still the same sort of argument that we have to be there or China will be there or the Soviet Union will be there. And also they think they're making the world better. They think somehow the world's going to be a better place. But it turns out in the end, so many of the things we do have unintended consequences. I mean, the unintended consequences, if you think Iran is a problem, Iran's more of a problem now that Saddam Hussein's gone since he was a counterbalance to Iran. So most of the things they do, even in practical real world circumstances, end up maybe having the opposite effect of what they think they intended.
So you mentioned Iran. I began writing about politics in 2005, and that was the same year when a lot of neocons who were very much in favor of the war in Iraq, but a lot of people in Washington who weren't neocons were as well. And there started to be this push to do what we did in Iraq and then do it in Iran. There was this notorious quote that real men don't stop at Baghdad, but go on to Tehran. There was kind of this fixation on the part of certain factions in Washington to have the U.S. go to war with Iran and change its government. Here we are 18, 19 years later, and just in the last month alone, we've heard people like Lindsey Graham and Nikki Haley demanding that the U.S. go and bomb Iran directly and bomb them hard. There's a lot of support for that now in the wake of this attack on the base in Jordan. What is behind the fixation in particular to have Washington go and start a war with Iran, which is, you know, three times the size of Iraq, a much more formidable military? What is behind that?
Well, I think they are naive in the sense that they think people or the pro-Western sensibilities and the pro-freedom sensibilities of the people of Tehran would be made more to our liking or more supportive of these causes or more supportive of being more like America once bombs are dropped on them. You know, I mean, does somebody propose there's ways of bombing Tehran without bombing any civilians? This is sort of the problem that you have in Gaza as well. Israel's mad. There was a terrorist massacre. And yet the more civilians and the more of the city that is destroyed, the more there inevitably leads to a longstanding problem. I mean, the problem doesn't go away, doesn't get better. The problem actually gets worse and worse and worse. I remember being in Israel in 2013 and meeting with Netanyahu, and I suggested to him, I said, why don't you build or allow Gaza to build? There's a lot of Arab money. Allow them to build a port in Gaza. And, you know, he said, we're worried about weapons. And I said, well, why don't you have joint security, kind of like we had in Panama for a long time, where the U.S. and Panama provided the security for the Panama Canal. Why don't you have joint security for a 10-year period or something with the port and see if you could allow them to achieve prosperity in Gaza? And Netanyahu's sort of droll response was, they have a port in Israel. And it's like, well, I mean, you can believe that and you can say we're going to be safe by doing that. But you have perpetual enmity that never goes away. And then you have to live in perpetual danger as well. But one thing I was struck by, well, Netanyahu wasn't very open to discussing any new ideas. I found that the people I met there and watching the news, that there was a much greater plurality of discussion and a much greater give and take, and opinions were open over there because, one, they can't call you anti-Semitic if you're in Israel and you're Jewish and you disagree with the Likud party. Over here, if you disagree with the Likud party, somehow you're anti-Semitic. And that's a real problem to debate in our country. But the debate in Israel is actually much more open and full of vigor than the debate is in our country.
There's this CIA doctrine called blowback that has been around for decades that basically says one of the costs for having the United States go around the world bombing a lot of countries, using our military, financing other countries' wars, it seems so basic, and yet if you point it out, people get very angry, is that eventually the people in those countries who we bomb, who we enable other countries to bomb, where we impose dictatorships, are going to get angry at you, and they're going to want to do violence back to you. It's a natural human instinct. It's part of the cost of all these deployments. Your father talked a lot about that in the 2008-2012 presidential primaries, and he was mauled by sort of the Rudy Giulianis and Mitt Romneys for suggesting that the U.S. might be contributing to the reason we end up in so much wars. This is a doctrine that seems so obvious, I think, to people who don't work in Washington, the idea that, of course, there's prices to pay for the United States. The more wars we involve ourselves in, the angrier we make people at us. Is this something that is genuinely recognized in Washington as an actual cause or cost of all of these wars that we continue to be involved in one way or the other?
I would say not in Washington, but I would say that since my dad stood on the stage and stood up to Giuliani and stood up to many of the bullies on the stage at that time, the opinion of the party has changed, and partly because of Donald Trump. Now, if he were here, he'd tell you he's a libertarian. I don't think he really is a libertarian, but he has some libertarian instincts and some instincts that are less intervention. He also has some instincts of not immediately reacting. You know, when the Iranians shot down one of our drones, Lindsey Graham and all the usual crowd wanted him to bomb Iran, bomb Tehran, and he didn't. He waited quite a while before responding, and the response was commensurate. So I think the party has changed, and I think it's actually much more popular for people to believe that we need to take care of things in our country before thinking we have to either lavish money on other countries or get involved in their wars. And Trump helped to actually popularize that. And it is much more popular in the party, and people are much more vocal. And I would say among the Republican caucus in the Senate, there's 49. There's 10 or 15 that on a good day can coalesce around some of those ideas. Doesn't mean they're either where I am or where my father is, but there are fellow travelers in that more than there used to be. But the majority here are neoconservative. The majority here are old Cold Warriors still fighting the Cold War. And the most of them have a very naive understanding, not a very realistic understanding. They have a black and white understanding. Putin bad, Russia bad, take their money. So we had this vote in our Foreign Relations Committee the other day. They're voting to take all Russia's money. And I said, well, you realize that the negotiation over whether you do or don't take might actually be a bargaining chip that could be used at the table by saying, you know what, if you'll come to the table, it's one of the things we'll do is we've threatened to take your money, but we might not actually take your money if we can get you to negotiate. So it could actually be a bargaining chip. But once you take the money, it becomes almost impossible to give it back. And a good example is Iran. South Korea bought oil from Iran, and then the money got intercepted by the U.S. And so recently, the Biden administration was going to release some of this money to Iran. And everybody started to see all the neoconservatives and all the people on the right, the Lindsey Grahams, Tom Cotton, saying, you're giving money to Iran. Well, no, you're releasing money you stole from Iran to begin with, but it becomes impossible. And then once the attacks happen in the massacre of Israelis by Hamas, once that happens, then everybody said, well, you can't give them the money back, and we're back to sort of square one on this. But I think as we look at this, someone's got to have an overall picture of what it means in the context of trying to get to a peaceful solution in Ukraine. But I think Washington's still dominated by black and white thinking over good and bad. And I'll give you one more anecdote. We're in a Foreign Relations Committee hearing, and I made a comment, and someone said, I don't care what Tehran thinks. And I said, well, the problem with that is in diplomacy, I may not agree with what Tehran thinks, but if I don't know what they think or try to conceive of how they're going to react to our policy, we're not going to have diplomacy. You can't move forward if you don't care what other people think. It doesn't mean they're right, but they assume that if you at all care about the reaction of your adversary, that somehow you're for your adversary. So it's very simplistic, juvenile kind of schoolyard thinking, but that's where most of the foreign policy is directed still in this town. The only hope is I think that the populace is not in the same place as actual people in Washington.
Speaking of that, and by the way, just before we get to this, you know, it was so ironic because it was Barack Obama who mocked Mitt Romney for saying that Russia was the gravest geopolitical threat to the United States. And he said, oh, the Cold War is calling, the 1980s are calling that wants its foreign policy back. And then 4 years later, it became almost prohibited in the Democratic Party to even question the idea that Russia is some grave existential enemy to the United States. And every Democrat, of course, has voted repeatedly yes to finance Ukraine's war against Russia. Let me ask you about what's being called this bipartisan bill, what's being called a border security bill that emerged out of these negotiations led by Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer. Obviously, there's a lot of debate about whether it really does anything meaningful to enhance border security or whether it even might make things worse, whether it's necessary. Just to leave that aside for a second, the bill proposes spending of $120 billion, the vast majority of which would not be spent in the United States or on the American border, even though it's called the Border Security Bill, but instead would be sent to other countries for financing the war. $60 billion to Ukraine, $17 billion to Israel to destroy Gaza, and then $10 billion to help the Gazans deal with the consequences of the destruction of that strip that we're helping pay for the destruction of. You said earlier that you think there's a lot of populist sentiment now in the Republican Party that just is tired of all this foreign spending and foreign wars, and I think you're seeing that in the reaction to this bill. What is your view of this bill insofar as the vast bulk of the money is to go to pay for the wars of other countries and not here stay at home in the United States?
Well, Glenn, you haven't been listening carefully to Mitch McConnell. He's explained to you the benefit of this. We send the money overseas, and then they buy our weapons. And he is really ecstatic that this is good for our weapons industry. My response to that has been that I think that's reprehensible. I think it's disgusting. Look, I'm all for profit for corporations, but I'm not for advocating for war anywhere, even if it's not Americans dying. I'm not for advocating for war because it increases the bottom line and the net profit of arms manufacturers. But that literally is the argument that he makes. But it also is the argument that the State Department under Blinken has made as well. We've had people come from the State Department. Assistant Secretary of State about 2 months ago came before me and made the same argument. And I just read it in the Riot Act and said, I mean, I think it's despicable that you would come here and say, oh, it's not so bad. The money's not really going overseas. Half of it's coming back to our arms manufacturers. But they literally will make that argument, which they should be embarrassed to make. But no, I think it's wrong. We don't have any of the money. You know, people don't realize this. All of the taxes that Americans pay for entitlements. You know, it could pay for whatever you decide for, but two-thirds of our spending is entitlements. We have enough tax money to pay for that. The remaining third, which would be the military and non-military discretionary, the budget that we vote on, which is about $1.5 trillion, is equal to the deficit. So people have to know that we only have enough tax money to pay for the entitlements, or you could say for the discretionary. But I think the entitlements, they're sort of, those programs are on autopilot, and we sort of, short of reforming them, have to pay for them. So really everything else is borrowed. And in addition to that, they come to us and say, we're going to spend $120 billion overseas, and none of it's going to be paid for. None of it will be taken from existing spending. None of it will be juggling priorities to say, well, instead of spending it here, we'll spend it here. I had a chairman of a committee look at me the other day and say, we shouldn't have to decide. I said, really? I thought that was our job to decide. I thought our job was to make priorities and say, this is more important than this. And it's funny, at every stage of government, in your local county or your city, when they go to pave roads, if your city brings in $10 million, they only have $10 million, and they have to decide which roads need to be paved that year, and they rank them in order of hierarchy. If they don't have any money, they pave the next roads the next time they get money. Only in Washington is it there are never priorities made. You never say, oh, well, we won't spend it over here this year because Ukraine's so important. I mean, if Ukraine were that important, they should take the $60 billion out of the $880 billion that the military is getting.
One of the things that I don't think has gotten nearly enough attention is, you know, on this issue of Ukraine, is the United States has spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $110 billion in terms of fueling the war in Ukraine. There's another request for another $60 billion, the largest authorization yet, if it's approved. It looks like it won't be, as of now at least, but one of the things that you were trying to do in each time it came before the Senate, obviously you knew that the vast majority of the Congress was in favor of funding this war. You were trying to say, at the very least, let's have the Inspector General that exists to do this be given oversight powers to trace the money, to make sure that it's actually going to its intended destination, its intended purpose. We're now getting reports, and I'm sure it's the beginning and not the end, of how much embezzlement there actually is in Kiev by officials in the Ukrainian government who were long notorious for being corrupt before this war happened, that a lot of this money is disappearing, it's being stolen, it's being embezzled. I don't think there was ever an argument offered, other than the time Mitch McConnell insinuated that you were some sort of pro-Kremlin propagandist, for why they were opposed to having the Inspector General monitor this money. What do you think was the real reason for their opposition to that?
What I proposed was a special Inspector General. This is what we have in Afghanistan. It's called SIGAR, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan. He's been doing it for about 10 years. He's got a team of 100 economists, accountants. He's found millions and billions of dollars misspent, and he points it out to them. One reason they don't want him is he's a thorn in their side. He's a thorn in the side of the war machine. And so he's pointed out all of these things. He found a hotel that was $80 million hotel where they built the skeleton of the hotel, ran off with $60 million and never finished the hotel. I mean, there's all kinds of craziness that happens in war zones. So he's there. He has a budget. I don't think he's got as much to do in Afghanistan. I'd move him from Afghanistan to Ukraine. And I thought he was the perfect pick. And because I'm fiscally conservative, I wasn't even going to give him any new money. He's got a budget of like $20 million. I was going to say, just move over or put a new plaque in his office called Ukraine instead of Afghanistan. They voted that down. Somebody else said, well, you know, Biden wants to be able to do the pick. What we'll do is vote on a special inspector general for Ukraine, but Biden gets to pick him, which wouldn't be as good a choice because who knows if he picks anybody good or not, but it's still a choice. That was voted down. And most of the people up here said, well, the Pentagon has an inspector general already. He can do it or she can do it. And I was like, well, yeah, this is the Pentagon that can't be audited and says they're too big to be audited. We're going to pick that person to be in charge of Ukraine now? It's crazy. But there is no good argument for them. They've kept up with that argument, but it's not a valid argument. And I think they look bad for it. The only malfeasance that we've been finding is actually from journalists within Ukraine that have put this forward. None of it's found. Our inspector general's found none of it, but Ukraine has fired some people. They've caught people stealing, and they were notoriously corrupt, as is Russia, you know, with all, both countries having oligarchs and both countries having corruption. And yet we send billions of dollars over there equal to Ukraine's GDP. $110 billion is equal to their entire economy's production for a year. And we send that over there without sufficient oversight. And I think that is a terrible thing to do.
So in the few minutes we have left, I just want to ask a couple questions about civil liberties and the government's attempt to control the internet. There have been two court rulings and it's amazing how little media coverage this has gotten, that has concluded that the Biden administration has gravely violated the free speech clause by coercing big tech to remove dissent that the Biden administration did not want to be heard, did not want to be circulated. The latest controversy is a call by some in the name of fears over China to try and ban TikTok, the social media app that is used by a third of Americans, that is the most popular app for young Americans. The last time they kind of riled up people's fears about TikTok and presented a bill to ban TikTok, it ended up vesting the government with far broader powers than just that. What is your view of this effort to have the U.S. government either ban TikTok or use the threat of banning TikTok to force TikTok to give them more control and influence over its censorship decisions?
You know, I'm against all government involvement with censoring speech, whether it's TikTok or Facebook or Snapchat or Twitter or any of these different organizations. I don't always like what they say. I mean, I don't like what Google did to me. I don't like what YouTube's done to me. I don't like them censoring my speech. But all I can do is come on a program like yours and complain about it in a free country. I would never use the apparatus of government to try to get even with people who don't like me or don't like my point of view. But I am very disappointed that while it's the same as that there's no real progressive left on war, there's not much progressive left on the First Amendment. Historically, the First Amendment was better defended by the left, going back into the 50s and 60s. The great cases were by the left. In fact, one of the big cases was Brandenburg. Brandenburg was some KKK guy out of Ohio, and he was saying awful things. But interestingly, I read this not too long ago. He was defended by the ACLU and was just, you know, had been historically depicted as being more from the left. But his young lawyers were Norton, Eleanor Norton, who's now the delegate from D.C. She was a young lawyer working, African-American. And then the other lawyer was a guy named Alan Brown or John Brown, but he was Jewish. So you have a Jewish person and an African-American defending this despicable person saying anti-Jewish, anti-black things, things you can't even, wouldn't even want to repeat anymore. And yet they were doing the right thing, defending speech, even reprehensible speech from a terrible person, because the concept of speech is so important. They interviewed Eleanor Norton recently on Trump and his speech on January 6th, where he says a lot of different things, and people can argue what he was saying, but he at least did say peacefully and whatever. But, you know, it's speech. It's a politician's speech, you know. And they ask her about it and compared it to Brandenburg, and she says, oh, yeah, but he should be convicted because that obviously was inciting violence. And it's amazing how people have lost their all perception. You know, where's the good liberal defending Trump's right to give a speech, even if you don't like him? And where's the good progressive left on war? But I'm against all of this. There are people on the right that want to ban Holly, want to ban TikTok. They also want to have commissions to determine what speech can be had. There's people like Murphy on the left that are wanting to stop speech. I think it's a terrible idea. And we really are going to get, you know, we're already sort of tribal, where we're each in our own corner. What if we're each in our own corner and then we ban the other tribe from their speech? It's a terrible, terrible world, and it'll lead to more strife when we start banishing people in their speech. So I think it's a bad idea, and I'll do anything I can from my perspective to say, look, I may not love the tech companies, but we need to stay the hell out of banning any kind of speech or breaking up tech companies because we don't like them.
Yeah, I can't express how much frustration I share with the disappearance of both free speech and anti-war sentiment in most of the American left and almost entirely from American liberalism. It's remarkable to see. Just one last question, and then I'm going to just ask you about Edward Snowden and Julian Assange, and then I'll let you go. You said in a 2022 Senate hearing, when the Homeland Security Secretary was there and was testifying about the government's attempts to influence the internet, and he justified it by saying we have to combat disinformation. And you said to him, quote, do you know who the greatest propagator of disinformation in the history of the world is? It's the U.S. government. What did you mean by that?
Well, some of the most famous instances of it, you know, are during war, during the Vietnam War in particular, you know, the casualty counts, the, you know, a lot of the facts coming out of the war to try to make the war look less bad were manipulated by the government. So I think there are a lot of instances of the government not being accurate. You know, you think of it, it's sort of like election interference. We say, oh, the Russians are interfering in the election. Who's the biggest interferer in elections historically? The U.S. government. I think over 115 times are documented where we've gotten involved with overthrowing governments or involved with their elections. No, I think we do worry about the government. I worry about misinformation coming from the government. And the only way to counter that is to have a good open platform where we aren't restricting private information. But it's really dangerous when you want to discern what is. And it's difficult. I'm not saying it's easy to know what the truth is.
Okay, that's all the time we have. You've been listening to a Glenn Greenwald interview with Senator Rand Paul, which you can find at rumble.com and then look up Glenn Greenwald. That's Glenn with two N's. And you can find this interview as well as a lot of other great programming. Thanks for listening to Class Matters. We'll be with you again next Monday.